Today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be talking about a doctrinal issue. So we're going to be a little bit more scripturally based. So I apologize in advance that I'll be I give lots of scriptures to begin with. So maybe even more than my normal. So I'll apologize in advance. But, we're a little bit over 30 days until the Passover this year. And of course, we know Passover is the beginning of God's holy day plans, is laid out starting in Exodus and then, of course, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And then all that we know about it from the New Testament and the meaning that it has. And it, being kind of the first holy day, the rituals were laid out in great detail in the beginning. And of course, the Israelites kept it, and its rituals were great, remembrance. And that's what we hear a lot about when it comes to Passover, is it was a great remembrance in the Old Testament of the deliverance that the Lord performed for the Israelites coming out of Egypt. And of course, he had foretold that it was going to happen many years before, right? 430 years before, he had told Abraham that he was going to make it happen. Of course, you wonder how much he told Abraham, like, I'm going to bring all these plagues and part the sea. And you wonder if it was literally just what's in the Bible, like, hey, we're going to, the Israelites are going to come into the promised land 430 years from now, or if it was, hey, let me tell you this great story that's going to happen. And of course, we don't know it, but we do know the story that happened and how impactful it was to the Israelites of the day and how powerful it is even for us and how much we can learn from it. And of course, then when you come to the church today, Passover is the most solemn of all the holy days, right? And it just, we can't help it, based off of what it reminds us of what it pictures, it has to be the most solemn day, right? It's a day that Christ himself, right, the one who was a God, came down, and not just came down as a person, but allowed his life to be ended, right? He had this ability to come and save it at any time, right up to the very end. He could have asked God to send down angels to both protect him and heal him, right? We know he had that ability, but he never did. He offered himself up as that Passover sacrifice. And so, he did it so that we could have our sins forgiven. And, think about this. Like, this day pictures a day where the one who was a God who would live forever was going to die. He allowed himself to die, and he did it for you and I. He did it because we caused it, us collectively, but also us individually. He would have come and died even if I had only sinned once. If I had been the only person to sin, he would have come just for me, just for that one sin. And we know, that it's not just me, and I don't have just one sin. I know it might be a little shocking, but I have more than one. But, he came and died for each of us individually, but also all of us, as humanity. And, he did this so that we could be washed permanently, so we could have our sins completely forgiven, completely washed over and cleansed by his very blood, right? And it's a powerful day. It's a day that, if you spend any, 5 seconds thinking about it, it's hard not to just be overwhelmed by how impactful, how powerful it is. And Paul makes clear that Christ is our Passover sacrifice. There in 1 Corinthians 5:7, it says, "Therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us." Right? Paul very clearly, very succinctly says that Christ was our Passover. So there's no reason to doubt how central Christ is as part of our Passover observance, as part of the meaning of the Passover. And, it's a time that we should stop and think about year after year what happened. Year after year is almost minimal amount of time, but we're there to remember what our elder brother did for us. Most people have brothers or sisters, and they're willing to sacrifice for us, right? Our physical brothers and sisters. But here, Christ, our our spiritual brother, the one who, you know, is enabling us to be in his family. He did this for us. And you think about the impact that it has on our lives, right? The love that he gave, the pain, the suffering that he went through, the selfishness, right? And all that is around his sacrifice, you know, it should be remembered. It should be a focus of ours every year, right? You know, as I say, it's minimally once a year. And given this magnitude of what we're remembering, you know, think about what we're remembering is someone that gave their life for us so that we could live for all eternity, right? How does that not just, you know, stop you in your tracks, the magnitude of it? And then you have God continuously telling us that this is a day that we're to remember what happened in the past. Of course, the Israelites were to remember what God had done for them coming out of Egypt, but we're called to remember what Christ did for us. And so we have a responsibility to not just do it in a haphazard way. We have a, you know, responsibility to do it with great care and purpose. You know, God calls us to remember it, not just kind of pass it by. And part of that, you know, is similar sentiment to what Paul gave or told to the Corinthians, right? A slightly different context, but, you know, what he was saying when he was telling them not to take it in an unworthy manner, he was telling them to take it with great care and responsibility. You know, give it the care and the feeding for what you remember from that day. You know, as impactful as it is, that's how powerful we should do it. Yeah, if you think about it, it's the greatest sacrifice that ever happened. And so we have a responsibility, you know, at least that one day a year to make it the greatest day of remembrance for that year. You know, it is only proportional to the sacrifice that Christ willingly did for us. And so, you know, it's not a time to take lightly. It's not a time to just do it, right? We know God didn't take it lightly. You know, God was sitting there on his throne with all power and ability to stop the suffering at any time, but he didn't. He went through it himself, right? It's a different process than what Christ went through, a different sacrifice than what Christ went through. But God the Father was up there, you know, and any of the physical parents know how much you would do for your child, right? And think about knowing you had full power and ability to save your only son from all the pain and suffering and then ultimately the death that he was going to go through. And you just sat there and you allowed it to happen. You watched it, you know? And of course, we as physical parents have some ability to protect, but not what God the Father does. And so, you know, Christ obviously didn't take it lightly. God didn't take it lightly. We're called to remember this day time and time again, how important it is. And so it's a time that we should, you know, give back in the same proportion. You know, it's not going to be identical. Of course, we can't ever give back in the same level, but we should take the same care and feeding of that day that is, you know, proportional to the sacrifice that God the Father and Jesus Christ gave to us on that day. But like many times in kind of the church history, there are disputes about how and when to keep the Passover. You know, even at the time of Christ, you had disputes between the Sadducees and the Samaritans and other Jewish sects about when to kill the Passover lamb. So they disagreed on when that should be done, right? The Pharisees killed theirs on kind of the afternoon of the 14th, so at the end of the day, whereas several of the other Jewish sects did it at the beginning or at twilight of the 14th. And we'll get into that. But also, if you read Philo, who's a Jewish historian and philosopher of the time and was contemporary of Christ and the apostles, you know, he wrote that there was even a dispute of how you sacrifice the lamb, right? Because many Jewish people slew the lamb basically at their house, like God had laid out. But others, like the Pharisees, thought the only proper way to do it was in the temple, that you had to go to the temple to sacrifice your lamb. And so, you know, we see even in the time of the Jews that there were disputes on what to do, right? And as I said, because the day is so important, because this day is so impactful, you know, we owe it to God to read his word and keep it as closely to what that word tells us as possible. And, you know, we should acknowledge that not everything is straightforward, right? We're, you know, none of us grew up in the time and the period of Christ. And so, and definitely not the time and the period and the language of the Old Testament. And so, you know, we have to acknowledge we're reading things through translations. You know, we're reading things that are not always 100% clear, right? And so what our responsibility is to put in the time, the effort, the focus to do it as closely as possible to what we read in the Bible. And ultimately, though, of course, we know what we have to do is we have to look to God for guidance. We have to look for God to help correct or you know, fix anything that we might be doing that's not exactly to his word. And then ultimately, we have to be humble enough that when we stand before God, you know, and he says, you know, you didn't quite do this right. You know, you didn't quite keep the Passover right. That's not really what I intended. And we have to say, like, you know, sorry, you know, forgive me for my sins and please show me where I made the mistake, right? Not just don't tell me the mechanical piece of where I made the mistake, but show me how I made the mistake. Show me what I didn't understand, what I wasn't willing to explore, what I didn't go in and learn that could have helped me do it better. And so, you know, I think whenever we look at these doctrinal issues, you know, we have to have a firm understanding of what we believe. We can't just kind of be wishy-washy and go with whatever the latest thing someone says. But we also have to be humble enough to say that ultimately God is going to come and correct all of us, right? And you know, I have firm belief in the foundational doctrines of the United Church of God. But, you know, if God comes back and says, you got this wrong and that wrong and this other thing wrong, I won't be 100% surprised, to be honest. We're human. If we sin in every other way and we don't sin in doctrine, I think we're fooling ourselves. But also, you know, I'll look to God to help correct me, help show me where I was mistaken and ask for his forgiveness. And so, you know, there's this fine balance of being very firm in our beliefs. And part of that firmness is because we go back and review it time and time again. I was talking to somebody before services, and I was telling a story, and I can't remember exactly when it was, probably 10 or 15 years ago, but, you know, it was not my first Passover, but it was, you know, maybe my third or fourth, and I remember sitting and thinking, like, wait a second, I don't actually know why we do it in the order that we do it. And so, like, I was a little, like, embarrassed, like, this is pretty sad, right? Like, here I am, I've done it a bunch of times, and I'm like, I don't quite remember how I can connect the dots. Now, you know, you can go back, and it took me probably 20 minutes of study of, like, just the lining the text and reading them through all together. And I was able, okay, yeah, this is exactly how you do it. But those things can creep in, right? And even if we've done it time and time again, it's good to refresh ourselves on why we do it. And as I said, particularly with the Passover and the magnitude that it should have for us, it's one of those. We want to get it as close to what we read in the scriptures as possible, right? So we, you know, again, maybe we're doing it wrong, and God will correct us in the time and the place that he will. But we have to go in every year with a firm foundation of why we're doing it the way we're doing, and be able to answer questions, right? When people come up, I don't know how many people in the congregation know, but in kind of this Pacific Northwest area right now, there's some doctrinal disagreements on when it should be kept, how it should be kept, what pieces should be kept, and all these kind of things. And so what I want to do today is, you know, to go through our fundamental beliefs and look at why we believe what we believe, right? And ideally, any of us, you know, if we're called upon by somebody, can go and do it. And if you can't do it, you know, you can go and study it and go and learn it relatively quickly. And so, you know, one, I'll be doing quite a few scriptures today. I'll try to go over them, so to give you the structure and not just read a bunch of scriptures to you. But you know, I'll be doing that. And you know, this will be pretty basic. I'm guessing all of you or a good number of you will say, I know that. Maybe you just studied it, you know, a week or two or had planned to study it in a week. So, you know, I will not apologize up front, but I will be, you know, up front on what we're going to do and the fact that it's not going to be necessarily any new truth, right? We're just going to go through the scriptures as they're laid out and hopefully see why we do what we do, right? Because, like I said, you know, of any day, this is the day that we have to just be rock solid on why we do what we do. Because what you're doing is you're memorializing Christ's death, his sacrifice for you. You're memorializing the pain and the suffering that God the Father went through watching his son die when he had full ability to go in and save him. And so we'll just, I'll read the fundamental beliefs and then we'll just kind of, or this fundamental belief, and then we'll go through it. So what the United Church of God's fundamental belief says here is, it says, we believe in observing the New Testament Passover on the night of the 14th of Abib, the anniversary of the death of our Savior. And so we'll look at two main pieces here. We'll look at what does observing the New Testament Passover mean, and is it something that we should do? And then the second one we'll look at, you know, is the night of the 14th of Abib the night that we should be doing it? So starting out in the first section, you know, we believe in observing the New Testament Passover. So if you start at the beginning, it's probably not the first time that the Passover was kept, but in Exodus, it's the first time that the Passover was laid out as far as how the Israelites were going to keep it. And so, you know, of course, we should look at things in chronological order. So we actually have to start at the beginning and see how Christ, or how the Lord told Moses for the Israelites to keep this day, and then start building up to see if what we do today is the way that we should do it. So here we'll begin in Exodus 12:7. It says, "And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts on the lintel of the house where they eat it." So this is one of the first things, right? So they're to take this blood of the lamb that they sacrificed, and we'll talk about when. So you know, right before this, it talks about the when, but here, you know, they've sacrificed a lamb, and so they're to take some of that lamb's blood, put it on the doorpost and the lintel of where they're going to eat it, right? So one of the commandments was if you were a small family, you could join up with other families. And of course, remember when this is, you know, this is as the Exodus, and so the death angel is going to be coming over, and so God had told them all to stay indoors this night. And so they, you know, even if they weren't in their own house, they were to gather together in groups enough to eat, you know, basically a small lamb and stay there, you know. So whatever house they chose was where the blood was supposed to go. And then in verse 8 it says, "Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it." And it says in verse 9, "Do not eat it raw nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails." So it's very detailed on how you're even supposed to cook it, right? So if you didn't like roasted lamb, this is that one night you had to, you know, kind of suck it up and just eat some of it. And then it goes on and it says in verse 10, it says, "You shall let none of it remain until morning," right? So here, very specific on how you were supposed to cook it, what you were supposed to eat it with. You were supposed to eat it with unleavened bread and the bitter herbs. And then if you had too much, right, you weren't to let it remain to morning. But here, you know, again, very specific. So, you know, they didn't have garbage disposals at the time, but you weren't supposed to, you know, put it down the garbage disposal. You weren't supposed to feed it to your dogs. You weren't supposed to do it, you know, any other way. It says if you have it remaining until morning, you were to burn it with fire, right? So very specific on how, you know, how you're supposed to do it. And in some ways, this should even tell you how important this day is, right? When God starts going to this level of detail, that he wants you to do it exactly the way that he wants you to do it, it should tell you something about the importance, right? Because often God talks about principles, right? You know, many of the things that God does is he tells us in principle how we do things. But when God starts telling us in detail, it means we should kind of sit up and really pay attention because the details are important. And then it goes on and it says, "And thus you shall eat it." And if it wasn't enough that he told you, you know, exactly how you were to cook it, exactly what you were to eat it with, and how you were to dispose of it. He's even clear on, as I throw my stuff around, he's even clear on the way that you're supposed to dress, right? This is pretty specific. So it goes on, it says, and thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It's the Lord's Passover. And then, again, this is repeated very close the following year. So in Numbers 9:11, this is the second year, it says, on the 14th day of the second month at twilight, they may keep it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs again. They shall leave none of it until morning, nor break one of its bones according to all the accordances of the Passover. They shall keep it, right? So God doesn't repeat everything, but he gives the high level. Like, you're supposed to do these things. Like, remember that I was very specific in my details. And then he says, and keep it with all the ordinances that I had given you previously. So, you know, not only year one does he tell them all this detail, year two, he reminds them about how they are supposed to keep the Passover. And so, you know, the question then is, why do we not follow that command, right? Because naturally, you know, God gave Moses this commandment of your command on exactly how they were supposed to keep the Passover, and we don't do it this way. Right, I've been with many of you for a number of years, and you know, we've never cooked a lamb together. I don't think many people have worn sandals, even though maybe some. No one's brought a staff, I believe. You know, probably the men wear belts, the women not so much, maybe. But you know, we just really don't keep any of it. And so the question is, why don't we keep it? Because that is, you know, the first commandment around the Passover. So. Yeah, so then we go and we start looking at what Christ showed. So then we can go into Luke 22, and we'll begin in Luke 22 because this is Christ keeping the Passover with his apostles. And so it says here in Luke 22:15, it says, "Then he said to them, he being Christ, with fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." So we see very clearly that Christ is saying, he's going to eat the Passover with his disciples, right? So no doubt about what's about to happen. And so we go on in Luke 22 and verse 16, it says, "For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." Now here, you know, I'll say some people start to look at this and say, well, this just really applies to Christ. You know, maybe if it was just in isolation and this was all we had, maybe it is. Maybe, you know, Christ is the one that's not going to eat this the Passover because he's going, you know, into heaven after this and won't be eating. But let's go on. Then it says in verse 17, it says, "Then he took the cup and gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body which is given to you. Do this in remembrance of me. Likewise, he took the cup after supper, saying, This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed, or in my blood, which is shed for you." And so we see here that, you know, Christ kept the Passover, likely very, very similar, if not identical, to what was laid out in Exodus. But then Luke and Matthew highlight a new part of it. You know, God or Christ came and said, "Here are two pieces that you need to know about." And he highlighted them specifically. Now, when you look at, you know, the Jews and how they kept the Passover, even now, the Seder meal, you know, of course, God told them to eat the unleavened bread, so that was part of it. And most Jews, even at, you know, that time and now, have wine as part of the meal, right? So this wasn't necessarily something new per se, right? This is something that the Jews were likely doing, and so the apostles were you know, likely very familiar with it. But they put an extra emphasis on it because Christ put an extra emphasis on these two pieces, right? He didn't call out the lamb, at least, you know, in their recount of what happened that Passover night, he didn't emphasize the lamb. He emphasized the bread and the wine, right? So it starts to tell us that Christ intended us to look at something slightly different. And, you know, from here, two potential questions could be asked, right? So One is, were these just one-time symbols that Christ gave to the apostles, right? Or is it something that he expected his followers to continue after him? And in these verses, we don't actually see, right? You might just say, because Christ did it, we should do it, but he's not actually explicit in it. And then the second one is, you know, if we do keep these symbols, should we keep it in conjunction with the Passover meal that was detailed in Exodus and Leviticus? And here we have Paul following up with a very clear answer, right? So in case there was any doubt coming out of Matthew and Luke's account, Paul lays out very clearly what the focus is for the New Testament church. And so here, you know, if you turn to 1 Corinthians, and we'll be here for a little bit, so if you turn to 1 Corinthians 11:17, Paul begins, it says, "Now in giving these instructions, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. The first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part, I believe it." Right? So here he's talking more general about when they come together. It says, "For there must also be factions among you, then that those who have proved may be recognized among you." And there in verse 20 it says, "Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper." Now, this verse 20 is you know, a pretty important verse here in trying to understand what Paul is talking about. Because, of course, many people take this to be the Lord's Supper as something completely different than the Passover. But here, if you look at the underlying words of the Lord's Supper, the Greek words, and I won't try to pronounce it, but basically the Greek words as they're interpreted is, instead of the Lord's Supper, it's more of an adjective being lordly. And so instead of saying here that it's the Lord's Supper, the translators likely got it wrong, where instead of the Lord's Supper, kind of the supper of the Lord, the most accurate way to say this would be the meal that was basically the meal that was initiated by the Lord. Right, so if you think about it in that context, what it's saying is basically Paul is saying that you had this Passover meal that was initiated, you know, by the Lord in the Old Testament, and then you had a meal initiated by the Lord that was slightly different focus in the New Testament. And here the Lord is, you know, the same one, but now gives a different focus in the New Testament. And then he goes on and is talking about what should be the focus. And so here in 1 Corinthians 11:21, it says, "For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and the another is drunk." So, you know, they were eating the Passover Seder as would have been common for the Jews at that time, and they were eating it like a meal, right? They were coming just like Moses had told them and eating at a meal. And, you know, apparently they had taken the to haste to heart and were basically like, "I'm going to go first and I'm going to eat the biggest," and, you know, all of these kind of things. And it goes on in verse 22. It says, "What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you, for I receive from the Lord." So here, Paul is setting context and saying, like, even though I wasn't at that first Passover, I received this instruction directly from the Lord. So it says, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread." And so here, Paul again reinforces these two new symbols, right? So, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it and said, "Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant of my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." Right? So again, he clearly answers that first question, right? Should we continue focusing on these two new symbols? So well after when Christ had died, Paul is saying, Christ told me how we were supposed to keep the Passover, and the focus was supposed to be now on these two symbols, the blood, or the wine and the bread, symbolizing his blood and symbolizing his body. Right? So it's very clear here, Paul is saying, you know, again, well after the time of the first Passover, that we're to focus the Passover night on these two symbols. Again, Paul doesn't talk about the lamb. He doesn't talk about some of the other parts that were in the Exodus, even though, you know, likely they were keeping it as part of this. He's saying, like, refocus. Focus on what Christ told me to tell you. And so, you know, it answers that first question fairly clearly. And then it goes on and it, you know, talks about examining yourself and not eating it in an unworthy manner. And those are all, you know, topics for another sermon, because you could have many sermons about them. But then we see the answer to the second one, which is, should we be coming together as a congregation or as groups and eating it, the meal, and just focusing on these symbols? Right, but it says in verse 34, it says, but if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. Right, so he's saying, if you want to keep the Passover in the traditional way, do it. There's nothing wrong with it, but just do it at home. Right, you don't have to do it as a congregation. And you see in the way that he's structuring it, he's basically saying, like, we have a new focus. Now, the Old Testament way of doing it is not wrong. Continue to do it if you want to do it, because you're still to remember the great deliverance that God gave the Jews out of Egypt. So there's nothing wrong with the old way. You know, it's not, you know, often how we will just, you know, discount the old way or say there's nothing valuable. He's not saying that. He's saying there's value, but the value in the old, you know, Old Testament way of keeping the Passover was always about keeping it in your house and remembering what God had done for Israel, particularly that first particularly the Exodus, where he protected them from the death angel and because of that brought them out of Egypt. But he's saying here, as a congregation, as a New Testament church, our focus is to shift. It's to shift away from the supper, which, fine, keep it, you know, continue to eat it at your house. But when you come here, when you come together as a congregation, as a church, in this New Testament context, in this, you know, body that's underneath Christ, focus on the bread and the wine, because that's what Christ had told Paul to focus on, and that's what Paul has instructed the congregation to follow, right? To follow the example of Christ. And so you know, I think it's pretty clear that we can see by putting these together that the reason why we keep it the way we do is because we follow the example of Christ with his apostles on that Passover before he sacrificed himself. And then Paul reinforced that was the new focus, that was the way we were to keep it. Not taking away from the old, but saying when you come together as a congregation, you're to do it with this focus and this mindset. And if you want to continue to keep the Passover as the Israelites had done for generations, do it at your house. Do it before you come together. So then you know, as those who've been at the Passover ceremony, you know, we have the bread and the wine. But then what about the foot washing? Because, you know, Luke and Matthew didn't talk anything about the foot washing. And here Paul doesn't talk about the foot washing. So, you know, it's a legitimate question, is like, why do we do the foot washing? But, you know, and in some ways, you know, we should just admit it. Like, it's a little bit hard to explain why Paul didn't talk about it. I can make some presumptions, right? And my best explanation is he's very focused on the meal, right? So the wine and the bread is part of the meal, right? And that was the thing that was most naturally connected to it. But, you know, he doesn't talk about the foot washing. And so, you know, if those were the verses that we had and that was all of the Bible we had, then, you know, we shouldn't have the foot washing. But we know that's not the case. So here, you know, when we look at the place where the foot washing explains, we have to turn to the book of John. We turn to John 13, and we'll begin in verse 1. It says, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come. So setting the context that this is part of that last Passover that he observed with his apostles, it starts to go on and tell. And it says, you know, it talks about the supper being ended. So this is part of the reason why we know the order. So they had done, you know, they'd had the supper. Judas Iscariot had already, you know, betrayed Christ or on the process of betraying Christ. And so it goes on, and in verse 3, it says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And then, of course, we know Simon Peter, being Simon Peter, goes over the top on both ways. And if it ended there, then, you know, there might be a reasonable discussion or a reasonable dispute of whether we should continue to keep it, right? Because maybe this was something that only Christ was to do. But we know John, just a few verses later, is very clear on what we're supposed to do. And so in John 13:12, it says, so when he had washed their feet and taken their garments, so he had done the whole process, right? He had washed all of their feet. He sat down again and he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? And he said, you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. So then, you know, we see here John is very clear that Christ wants us to follow his example. Now, there are some questions here, right? Because Christ, you know, didn't necessarily say wash feet at the Passover, you know, in conjunction with the bread and the wine. And so we do have to put some of it together. But here, you know, Christ is saying, I have given you an example, then you should do as I have done. And what was the example he gave? At the Passover, he washed the feet of the disciples. So is it, you know, the example to just at random times throughout the year to wash other, you know, wash other disciples' feet and not do it at the Passover? Or should you follow the full example of what Christ did and do it at the foot washing? Or, do it at the Passover? And again, it doesn't spell it out word for word, but when you look at this example, Christ is pretty clear. Follow his example. He did it at the Passover. He wants us to do it at the Passover. You know, it makes more sense that he wants us to follow his full example versus, you know, if he wanted us to just do it at random times. You know, and so when you look at it, it seems to be very clear what Christ is wanting us to do. Follow his example at the Passover to wash other disciples' feet. And that is why we do it. And so, you know, then it becomes a question of, like, why was only John the one to add it? And frankly, we don't know. And in some ways, it just doesn't matter, right? Because we see what Christ wanted. We see the intent of what Christ had. And if you look at the law, there's actually many places where you take the sacrifices, or you take the holy days, or you take a part of the law about, you know, about a particular piece, and it's scattered throughout Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomies, right? So it's not uncommon for God to kind of put stuff all over the place, and you can ask why and all these things, but it's just how he does it, right? He doesn't always give you this, like, very succinct, here's the checklist. You know, they didn't have bullet points, so he doesn't have that, you know, bulleted list of things that we're to do. But we see it fairly commonly that, you know, especially as the sacrifices, as an example, you have each of the sacrifices spelled out very clearly. And then a few chapters later, you have some additions to all of them. You know, why didn't he just combine it all into one? I don't know, but that's just how he does it. And he does it, you know, very commonly. And so, you know, as I say, given the fact that he talks about the Passover here and, you know, Matthew and Luke, and then he talks, you know, Paul talks about it in Corinthians, and then John talks about a slightly different aspect, it's not an uncommon way for God to describe what he expects us to do. Yeah, and if you think about it, there's likely a number of reasons why John did this. You know, the one that would come to the top of my head, and I don't know that this is true, right? I'm kind of making it up, but, you know, if you think about it, John is the last of the apostles. He was there that night. He knew exactly what Christ was emphasizing, and he also knew the breadth of things that were being written, right? Because he wrote his, you know, his epistle, not epistle, his gospel, sorry, well after everyone, you know, most of the other books of the Bible were written. And so it's easy to imagine that he's seeing all of these things being written and this emphasis on the bread and the wine, and he's saying, okay, you know, in my account, what I need to make sure is, even though they're doing it right then, I need to make sure for future generations they know this other part is very important. And so it's not hard to imagine, you know, how it would come about in that way. And again, I have no reason to believe that's exactly what happened. Maybe as good an explanation as anything else. But just the point is, it's not uncommon for God to do it that way. And there's a number of, you know, logical reasons why it might have come down in that way, where it's only John that's talking about it. And, you know, we do have to be careful, because often we want to see multiple examples of something, right? We want to see it in two or three or four different places. But when things are so clear, like it is here in John, we can rely on that one example. We don't have to go look for, you know, four or five different examples to make us sure of what God intended. You know, when it's very clear, on things that are a little bit less clear or, you know, a little hazier, then we do want multiple examples. But here, where it's just so clear what Christ did and what he intended for us to do, we can use that one example as something to follow. And again, as I say, you know, I don't believe it. I read it very clearly. But if God comes down and says, I didn't intend you to do the foot washing at the Passover, then we have to be humble enough to say, you know, God, here's the reason why I did it. I did it out of love for you. I did it out of love for your son. I tried my best. Forgive me for my sin and help correct me, right? And so, you know, again, it's this important balance of being very firm in what we believe, understanding why we believe, but also being humble enough to say, if God comes down and tells us differently, I'm not going to argue with him, right? You don't want to get in the argument with God that says, I don't think you quite have, you know, down what you intended us to have. Or, God, why didn't you spell it out clearly enough for us, right? No, he spelled it out clearly. If there's any misunderstanding, it's on us to you know, go to him and look for it. But here it's very clear what God intended. And when we look at these scriptures across the Gospels and Paul and whatnot, we see a very clear focus, a reshifting of the focus of the Passover night to these three things, the bread, the wine, and the foot washing. And when we understand what the Passover now means, right, because we know what it meant, which is the deliverance of the Israelites out of Egypt, and now we know it's Christ's sacrifice delivering us out of this sinful world, it makes sense that there was a shift in the focus, right? And if you think about it, this is probably the only, I'll say probably, I'll cage it a little bit, but probably the only holy day that has been completely, completely made whole, right? That the spiritual meaning of it is complete, because you even have the other spring holy days where there are processes that's happening now, right? Where you have the days of unleavened bread, each of us bringing Christ into our lives, but that's happening to each and every one of us individually. And then you have the Pentecost where, yes, the church has been built, but the church isn't complete. So, you know, every other spring holy day is still a work in progress. But here you have the Passover, it's been completely fulfilled. Like, there's no more parts to it. We know exactly the final fulfillment of it. And so, you know, it does make logical sense of why God would shift the focus from the physical deliverance of Israel out of Egypt to now the spiritual deliverance of his people out of Satan's world. So now, having laid out the case of why we observe the, you know, quote-unquote New Testament Passover, now let's move on to when it should be observed. And here in our doctrinal statement, we say on the night of the 14th of Abib. And this comes fairly clearly from the first mention of the Passover. So if you turn back to Exodus 12, we'll begin in verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be your beginning of months, and it shall be the first month of the year to you. speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for the household. So we see the beginning of the instructions of the Passover. And here it says, and if in verse 4, and if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the person. So, you know, the goal was to not leave any of it left over, right? You didn't really want to burn the Passover lamb unless you had to. And so, you know, if you had two people in your household or maybe three or, you know, a couple young kids, you would combine with someone, you know, another household so that you could eat the whole or come very close to eating the whole Passover lamb. And it says, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. And then here in verse 6 is the key. It says, now we shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. So on the 14th day of the month of Abib, the Israelites were to kill it at twilight. Now, this word twilight is important here because this tells us when we should keep it. Because as I said, you know, the dispute, especially at the time of Christ, was that some of them killed it right at twilight on the 14th. Some of them killed it right at before twilight on the 15th. Right, so they were, you know, almost 24 hours apart on when they kept it, or when they killed it, and we'll see this later on in the New Testament. But you know, we of course keep it at twilight on the 14th, and this twilight word is a Hebrew 6:1-5:3, and this particular word is fairly vague, but there's other words that are more clear. But, you know, twilight is that time between sundown and when it's dark. So I don't know how many hunters are out there, but, you know, if you go hunting, you're allowed to basically hunt until it gets dark. So the end of twilight is generally about 30 minutes after sundown, right? So there's this period of time where the sun is down, but it's still bright enough that you can see, that you can do stuff. And, you know, as I say, if you're hunting or if you're working or if you're sacrificing a lamb, you have enough light that you can do your job, right? You can take care of what needs to be taken care of. And so this is the period that it's talking about is this, you know, it's fairly brief, but it's this period between sundown and then when it's dark outside that you still have enough light that you can go about your everyday activities. And so here they were called to kill the lamb at twilight. And so then the question becomes, you know, which twilight? Do you do it at the beginning of the 14th? You know, basically, do you do it right after sundown or you do it right before sundown? And that kind of gauges where you go. And here, of course, you know, we need to look for somewhere else of what's going to, you know, help us understand when that should be. And the place that we go to understand the orders of the day from God's perspective is Genesis. Genesis lays out fairly clearly the order in which God lays out his days. It's different for us. You know, generally, you know, with midnight, it's kind of quite dark, you know, well into night, and then we go into the new day. But God, of course, called a new day, the beginning of a day, to happen at sundown, not kind of in the middle of the night. And we see here in Genesis, we'll read in several of these, but Genesis 1 verse 5, it says, God called the light day and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day, right? So he started with the evening, and this word evening is the same word that's used for twilight in Exodus. So it's the exact same word that's matching up. And so we see here on the first day, he said the evening and then the morning. And then in verse 8, it says, and God called the firmament heaven, so the evening and the morning were the second day. So he did the exact same order on the second day. And in verse 13, so the evening and the morning were the third day. And then verse 19, so the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And then in verse 23, I'm guessing you can guess by now, right? So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And then if there was any doubt on the order in which God had his days, in Genesis 1, verse 31, it says, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day." So here we have six examples where God is saying evening, twilight, then the morning. And so, you know, it's very reasonable to believe that what God intended here was on the twilight of the 14th, which, you know, for us would be the 13th by how we do our days, but at the very beginning of the 14th, you were to slaughter the lamb, you were to cook the meal, you were to do it in haste, and you were to have it all done before morning, right? And so you had this period between twilight and, you know, essentially sunrise, I guess, where you had to sacrifice the lamb, get it all ready, cook it, roast it as it was described, eat it, and then burn it if you had any left. And then if, you know, God was not clear enough, as we read before, in Numbers 9, 1 through 5, he again repeats this example. So this is the second Passover that they were to observe. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, 'Let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time on the 14th day of the month at twilight.'" Again, the same word that we saw in Genesis, the same word that we saw in Exodus, "You shall keep it at its appointed time." Right? And here he says the appointed time. So he's pretty clear. He says, I want you to keep it at this time that I told you. And we actually see this many times throughout the Old Testament. So during the time of Joshua, it says, "Now the children of Israel," Joshua 5:10, "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho." And then it says, "And then they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on that same day." And then there was a great revival under Hezekiah, and it talks about this again. Here in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 1, it says, "And Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah and wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh." So Hezekiah was the king of Judah, but he sent letters to basically everyone. He was trying to bring the children of Israel back to God. And it says, "And that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Lord God of Israel." And then dropping down to verse 15, it says, 2 Chronicles 30, verse 15, it says, "Then they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day of the second month. The priests and the Levites were ashamed and sanctified themselves and brought the burnt offerings to the house of the Lord." So again, this 14th day of the month. Then again, King Josiah. This is 2 Chronicles 35, verse 1. "Now Josiah kept the Passover to the Lord in Jerusalem, and they slaughtered the lambs on the 14th day of the first month." And even after the exile, so now Ezra comes back. And it says in Ezra 6, verse 19, "And the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, for the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean." And this was... where was it? When Hezekiah kept it on the second month, this was essentially the second Passover because they weren't ritually clean, which is why they kept it the 14th of the second month. But it was always this 14th of the month. And so when we see this, there's clear evidence in the Old Testament that they were to keep it very much like any other holy day. They were to keep it from sunset on the 14th to sunset at on the end of the 14th, but the primary difference being that while, you know, most of the other holy days were kept primarily during the day, so the second half of whatever day or days they were supposed to be, we see very clear commandment from God that this is supposed to be kept at the very beginning of the 14th, which is, you know, exactly what we do. And so then the question, you know, Old Testament scriptures are very clear on when we're to keep it, if you look at kind of them as a whole. So then the question is, you know, did maybe Christ change something, like he changed the focus of the day, right? Because, we have to acknowledge Christ changed the focus of the day from the Passover meal to the blood and the wine and the bread and the foot washing. And so, you know, did something like that occur on the day that we are to keep it, or the period of time that we are to keep it? So moving into the New Testament, we can read in Luke 22, verse 7, it says, "Then came the day of unleavened bread," that's Luke 22, verse 7, it says, "Then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. And he, being Christ, sent Peter and John, saying, 'Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat.'" And verse 9, "So they said to him, 'Where do you want us to prepare?' And he said to them, 'Behold, when you enter the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house which he enters. Then you shall say to the master of the house, "The teacher says to you, where in the guest room where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" Then he shall show you a large furnace upper room. There make ready." So they went and found it just as he had said, and they prepared the Passover. So we read this, but it doesn't really tell us, you know, do we keep it at the beginning or the end? But there's an interesting part in John, because as I'd mentioned at the beginning, there was a disagreement between the Pharisees and most of the other Jews about when to keep it. The Pharisees kept it at the end of the 14th, so at the very end of the day, and most of the rest of the Jews kept it on the night of the 14th. And so we see here, you know, Christ, when he says, "Go prepare the Passover," they go in, they talk to an innkeeper, and the innkeeper's not surprised when they're going to keep it, right? You would imagine if everyone was keeping it at one period, you probably ask, like, "Why are you keeping it this night? Are you sure it's the Passover? You know, I think you have your days wrong," something like that. But here we see in John 18, verse 28, this is when Christ is being brought before Pilate. It says, "Then they led Jesus." So they ate the Passover meal. They did the bread, the wine, the foot washing. They sang the hymn. Then they, you know, Christ went out. He prayed to God three times. Then Judas brought the temple guards. They arrested Christ. They brought him to the high priest. They had the trial. And so now it's the morning, and as we'll see, the 14th, and they're bringing him to Pilate. And so it says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas, the high priest, to the Praetorium, and it was early morning," so early morning of the 14th. "But they themselves," so the high priest and everyone that was around him, "they did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover," because they were eating the Passover at the end of the 15th. And so we see very clearly that Christ kept it the night of the 14th because the Pharisees didn't want to be unclean. Now, it's interesting, they were happy to be unclean, you know, to send a man to his death, but they didn't want to be unclean by going into the Praetorium. But they were going to eat it that night, the night that Christ was died. And so when you put these together, you know, you see the order of the day. And if you look at it, it's very similar to, you know, how we might write about, let's say, the Sabbath and Sunday, right? We wouldn't, you know, because we believe the Sabbath is the Sabbath and we, you know, go to church on the Sabbath, and many Christians go to church on Sunday, we wouldn't necessarily describe in great detail all the reasons why we don't go to Sunday if we're describing the flow of events, right? Because, you know, Christ said, "I'm going to keep the Passover, I'm going to keep it the night of the 14th, or, you know, the night," and then the Pharisees were keeping it the next night. So they didn't go into all the doctrinal disagreements and why someone believed what. Christ kept it on this night, likely had been the same night he'd kept it every day for his life, so it wasn't something new to him. And again, because he wasn't a Pharisee, most of the other Jews kept it different than the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees were the ones primarily that kept it on the 15th. And so Christ, not being a Pharisee, would have likely kept it on the 14th every night. And he, you know, likely would have not gone to the temple to kill the Passover lamb. He would have done it with his family at home as it was described in Exodus. And so, you know, it's not, you know, if we think about how we write it, it wouldn't be uncommon for us to just, you know, say we went to church on one day, and then, you know, there were other churches being held on the next day, right? Because it's kind of was common knowledge of the disagreements and all the doctrinal issues at the time. And so it wouldn't be unreasonable to think they would just write it this way. But when you put it together, it lays out the clear timeline of why we keep it the night of the 14th and not during the day, or, you know, or later afternoon and into the 15th. So, you know, again, this is probably pretty basic. Most people, you know this, so this isn't new truth. This is just walking through the scriptures as they're laid out. But it's important to remember the magnitude of what we're doing, right? Again, we can't keep the Passover in just a haphazard manner. We can't go about year after year not being clear why we do exactly what we do. And as you saw in the Old Testament, God was very clear, minute details on what they were supposed to do, you know, how they were supposed to cook it, what they were supposed to cook it with, where they were supposed to put the blood, what they were supposed to wear, how fast they were supposed to eat. Right? God, when it comes to the Passover, details matter to him. Details matter to God when it comes to the Passover, and it's not hard to understand. Because, again, his son sacrificed himself. He watched his son sacrifice himself on this day. He wants us to remember it as he wants us to remember it. He doesn't want us to go do slightly different things. He doesn't want us to just say, oh, this year we'll keep it this way, another year we'll keep it this way. Again, you know, we have to keep it in the way God tells us to keep it. And we have to dig into our Bibles and look at why we do what we do and be willing to look at, you know, are we wrong? And I think when you go back and look again, you'll see a very clear, laid out case of why we do it the way we do it. And it's the way, you know, with the heft of scriptures, it tells us to do it in a certain way. And again, we have to be humble enough that if God comes down and says, you're doing it wrong, we don't want to argue with him. But we also need to be firm in our convictions. Because this is, again, the day that our Savior let himself die for you and I. The day our Father let his son be killed so that we could be in his family. Right? This is not a day to, you know, mess around with. It's not a day to just kind of walk through haphazardly. It's not a day to just let anything go. It's a day that we should have the right respect, the right focus, the right understanding of why we're doing what we're doing. Right? We shouldn't take it lightly because God and Christ didn't take it lightly on our behalf. So brethren, you know, as we get, you know, into the Passover season, or as we're entering the Passover season, you know, let us dive back into the Word of God as often as needed, right? If it's every year, every day, every month, every couple of years, to reaffirm the truth that we have, particularly around this day, that we're clear of why we do what we do, and that we give the right respect to our Father and our elder brother and the sacrifice that they made.